casa teva. My house in your house.
Thank you. Yeah. So, you always heard The One You Love by Molly Nielsen. And then it was Early Bird by me, back when my artist name was Heidi Mortensen. Now it's Thalo. And this, what you just heard, was, of course, Fortet with a very beautiful track called Lush. Indeed it is. And obviously he's using the steel pans. Yeah. If you aren't familiar with the steel drums, it's actually a chromatically pitched percussion instrument invented in the 1930s in Trinidad and Tobago. And it's crafted from like a 55-gallon industrial oil drum, where the drum head is hammered into a concave ball and meticulously hand-tuned to produce distinct musical notes. Yeah, we like, I like. So let's move on and see if you can guess the next track. Wow.
In 1984, as part of the press for the tour I was doing in Japan, I was asked to go to Bali and speak about the future with the Prince of Ubud. Now, the idea was that I would represent the Western world, the Prince, the Southern world, and the Japanese press representative would represent whatever was left. The conversations were to be published in a large book, scheduled for release 1 year after the concert tour. Now, as press, this didn't really seem like a great way to advertise concerts, but it sounded like fun anyway. And I stayed at the palace in one of the former king's harem houses. Each of the king's wives had had her own house guarded by a pair of animals. A bear and a fox, for example. By the time I got there years later, the menagerie had dwindled a bit. My house was guarded by two tropical fish. Bali was extremely hot in the afternoons, and the conversations with the prince drifted along randomly from topic to topic. The prince was a bon vivant, trained in Paris, and he spoke excellent English, and when he wasn't in the palace, he was out on the bumpy back roads, racing cars. So we talked about cars, a subject I know absolutely nothing about, and I felt that, as far as representing the Western world was going, I was failing pretty dismally. Then, on the second night, the prince served an elaborate feast of Balinese dishes. At the end of the meal, the conversation slowed to a halt, and after a few minutes of silence, he asked, "Would you like to see the cremation tapes of my father?" The tapes were several hours long, and were a record of the elaborate 3-month ceremony shot by the BBC. When the king died, the whole country went to work building an enormous funeral pyre for him. After months of preparation, during which time the corpse continues to reside in the living room, they hoisted the body to the top of this rickety, extremely flammable structure and lit a match. The delicate tower crumpled almost immediately, and the king's body fell to the ground with a sickening thud. Suddenly, everyone began to cheer. Later, I learned that the Balinese believe that the soul is a bird, and that when the body falls, it shakes the bird loose and gives it a head start on its way to heaven.
My house in your house.
My house in your house.
Yes, we're at the end of this episode, and I wish you all a great summer. Obviously, you guessed that it was Laurie Anderson, and after that, it was Glynis Jones from the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. Her track was called Magic Birds. And you just heard Fortet with LA Trance. Yeah, let's take a deep breath and get some sun. I really hope you all are coping and feeling good, and that you have an opportunity to get out in nature and enjoy it while it is still here. And obviously listening to a lot of music. And on that note, I can tell you that it's 3 o'clock here and dawn is starting to happen. It's actually starting to get more bright outside. I can see the northern lights from my window. They're not super bright, but they're definitely alive and dynamic. Even it's in its own subtle way, I can see the green color. And I can see the silhouettes of the fields from the bottom. It starts with a red color, also still very subtle, like red-orange. And then it just goes into a yellow and green aurora, and then it's going into light blue, still kind of gray blue because it's not daylight yet. And I can see it's like someone painted a few nice dark blue gray strokes on the sky. And yeah, so it's clearly starting a new day. Anyway, just sending you a lot of optimism and care from my little place here in the woods. And yeah, come see the Nordic summer for yourself. All right, take care and see you in August, where it's my birthday. Take care, y'all.
Bye!
Thank you.
My house is your house.
The high-profile arrest of an alleged criminal businessman in St. Petersburg, Bianditsky Petersburg, is a useful reminder that the sins of the wild 90s can't be forgotten until everyone who remembers them is behind bars or in the ground. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. Okay, so I'm recording this and will be releasing this a day earlier than usual, on Saturday the 20th of June, in part because, quite frankly, this is a story that excites me to my dark soul with its particular problematic interest in Russia's gangsters, and also because there's a lot of nonsense being talked about this case, and it'd be nice to put some of the myths to bed. But anyway, let me just start with a parallel. Back in 2007, Vladimir Kumarin, also known as Vladimir Barsukov, was relaxing in his mansion in St. Petersburg when 300 heavily armed police special forces, backed by armoured personnel carriers with helicopters above, stormed it. He was quickly whisked away to Moscow, not least to ensure that he couldn't draw on his own connections in St. Petersburg to somehow get out or whatever. I mean, even the police special officers who had been brought in came from outside St. Petersburg. And then Prosecutor General Yuri Chaika accused him of banditry, of organising a gang, and of being behind the attempted murder the year before of Sergei Vasilyev, who was a rival in the oil business. Two men with assault rifles had raked Vasilyev's car, wounding him and killing one of his bodyguards. And eventually, he was sentenced to 24 years for these crimes. But of course, these weren't really the crimes that had actually got him arrested, particularly not in such a high-profile manner, thankfully a thoroughly performative manner. They didn't need all these special forces and armoured personnel carriers or whatever. They just wanted to make a point. Kumarin's real crimes were to have been a little bit too visible, a little bit too free with tales of the 1990s when his Tambovskaya gang was making money hand over fist in St. Petersburg, not least thanks to deals which had been arranged with the deputy mayor, one Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin. And then, also more immediately, Kumarin refused to back down from a business deal in favour of a politician close to Putin. And what we've seen has been part of that social contract, shall we say, that Putin had established with organised crime from when, right at the beginning, he came to power as president in 1999-2000, was this: you don't do anything which looks like a challenge to the state. And by state, we also mean Putin himself. Nothing that's going to embarrass us. So, you know, we're not talking about, obviously, being a little bit too free with information from the dirty deals of the 90s, but also not the kind of car bombings and drive-by shootings, which made it look as if the state wasn't in control of the streets. Well, refrain from that. And yes, of course, the cops are still going to try and catch you, but we won't treat you as a security issue, and with all the additional priority and resources that intends. However, from time to time, people overstepped these understood boundaries, or just simply the Kremlin decided it was time just to give people a reminder of whose was the biggest gang in town. So we would tend to have these highly performative arrests. One can also draw a parallel with, in 2013, the arrest of Said Amirov, former mayor of Makhachkala, the capital of Dagestan, and very much the local kingpin. Actually, he was known as Bloody Roosevelt because of his reliance on a wheelchair after a 1993 assassination attempt left him paralysed, the bullet in his spine, but also the amount of deaths that seemed strangely to have happened to his enemies. And today, Said Amirov is still serving out his life sentence at the notorious Black Dolphin, maximum security penal colony in Orenburg region. Black Dolphin really is a very, very serious establishment. There's actually some quite good documentaries out there that you'll find on YouTube if you're interested. So, you know, every now and then it's necessary to bring people to heel, either just simply to remind organised crime that the state gets to define the limits of acceptable behaviour, which is, it has to be said, under pressure at the moment because of a certain amount of turmoil and turbulence within the underworld, or else because individuals are seen to become a little bit too problematic. Now, the reason I'm raising these examples is that on the 17th of June, an FSB team, again heavily armed, going in mob-handed, arrested Ilya Traber, who is more widely known within especially the underworld as Antiquar, the antiques dealer, the antiquarian. But he had long since outgrown any antique dealery. He's now a fabulously wealthy owner of oil ports in Ust-Luga and Primorsk, as well as the Leningrad Regional Electric Grid Company and lots of other enterprises, businesses, real estate, and whatever else. But still, for now, his property essentially is limited to a cell, in that Moscow's Basmianny Court has remanded him in pre-trial detention for 2 months while a case is being prepared. Now, look, if Kumarin was St. Petersburg's Vito Corleone, you know, the old Don Corleone, the 74-year-old Traber is more like his son Michael, the mobster who's interested less in codes, traditions and respect, and more in business. And look, this is a big deal for a whole variety of reasons, so bear with me as I again indulge my unhealthy passions with these people. Even according to Peskov, Putin's press spokesman, Putin and Traber have known each other since 1995. And Traber was indeed once quite socially close to Putin, though not in the past decade or so. Not one of his true friends, but the sort of person who certainly got invited to his parties. And Traber was also associated with Nikolai Shomalov, co-owner of Rossiya Bank, and very much a close Putin confidant. And Nikolai is the father of Kirill Shomalov, who was formerly married to Putin's daughter, Katerina Tikhonova. So you can already begin to get a sense of just how intricate, interconnected, and almost incestuous the ties were within Banditsky Petersburg. Putin and Traber were primarily connected through business, and not the most savoury variety. Because frankly, Traber made his first solid stakes during Putin's tenure as deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. There is a claim that Traber actually is a man who introduced Putin to future mayor Sobchak. That's not the case, actually. Sobchak was one of Putin's law professors at Leningrad State University, so they had a previous history. Now, Traber had been a submariner, not a tremendously successful one, but a submarine officer. Then, through the 80s, he was a bartender. In 1989, though, taking advantage of the economic liberalization under Gorbachev, he established himself as an antiques dealer. And not just any antiques dealer. He was smart. What he did was he established a joint venture with the city that essentially gave him a monopoly on the legal antiques trade in Leningrad. Remember, this was still Leningrad. Because he realized that a desperate city administration needed money, it was also pretty clueless about the emerging market economy. And that made it a very useful partner because it also had power, precisely the power to grant monopolies and so forth. And in this particular business, Traber actually was a majority shareholder. So he had all the weight of City Hall behind him, but he still controlled the business. Now, this predated Putin, but it did mean that Traber was already a known quantity in City Hall, because he then also used that as a basis to set up a whole bunch of new businesses, again, usually with the city having a minority stake. Now, Putin very quickly became not just deputy mayor, but chair of the Committee for External Relations of the mayor's office, which meant that his job was to essentially broker deals and handle all the liaison with whoever needed to be liaised with, whether this meant Tambovskaya. It's worth remembering that Kumarin's nickname at the time was the Night Governor. The idea was that the legitimate authorities may be in control by day, but by night, by night St. Petersburg is Tambovskaya's. So it ranged from him through to people like Traber, who were much more on the borderline between gangsterdom and the emerging market economy, and, well, even frankly, foreign companies. But this meant that Putin got to know Traber better and steered business his way, but not for free. Now, one of the key things that definitely shaped Traber's emerging career as a magnate was in the 1990s, he took on a big stake of the St. Petersburg oil terminal. And in some ways, he was acting as the sort of the accountant and the front for Tambovskaya, but in part, it was very much also on his own account. And this was a process that was, shall we say, midwifed by Putin and accompanied by a lot of blood. I mean, the trail of murders included the former port captain, his head of security, and so forth. Then, in 1995, Traber got a contract for refueling at St. Petersburg's Pulkovo Airport. Putin allegedly wanted 15% of the profits, but in the end they settled for him getting 4%. But again, that gives you a sense of how these deals worked. He makes sure that you get the deal, a deal that you're going to make a lot of money off, and in return he expects a cut. And, of course, he also looks after his friends. The next year, 1996, Putin's deputy at the Committee for External Relations, Alexei Miller, who is now CEO of Gazprom, in other words, one of the richest and most powerful economic figures within the Putin system. Anyway, Miller, who worked for Putin at this time, was appointed Director for Development and Investments at the Port of St. Petersburg. So hands are washing each other left, right and centre. But of course, anyone who gets in the way, well, Traber has a no-nonsense approach to non-competition clauses. In 1997, he is suspected, very frankly seriously suspected, of being behind the assassination of Mikhail Manevich, deputy governor of St. Petersburg, with the portfolio, tellingly enough, of city property management. Now, Manevich was very much on the liberal reformer side of politics at the time, and quite possibly wasn't in tune, shall we say, with the Putin approach to handling city property. Now, Trabo had apparently moved to Europe in the late 1990s. It's hard to know exactly when. And he was active in Spain, in Switzerland, and in Monaco, building up a network of companies that frankly looked very much like money laundering fronts for Tamboskaya, for himself, and probably for anyone else who wanted to take advantage of them. However, in due course, he came to the attention of the authorities, particularly in Spain. In 2016, he flees back to Russia when charges were brought against him there, although he was then cleared of all charges in 2018. For me, slightly strange outcome, but there you go. So Taraba is once again based in Russia, and he's involved in a whole range of activities, particularly relating to the oil industry and oil exports. And he owned just under a third of a project to build a new deep water Baltic port in Primorsk. Now, you might wonder, how is this being built? I mean, a massive oil port is a huge investment. Well, in 2021, the CEO of one of Trabir's companies wrote directly to Putin, requesting 220 billion rubles in financing it. Putin scribbled "consider it" on the letter and forwarded it to Andrei Kostin, chair of Vnesheconombank. And guess what? Surprisingly enough, Kostin did consider it, and the 220 billion rubles were forthcoming. So we have this Primorsk port being built. But then, of course, in 2022, we have a special military operation, and recognizing the new needs of the time, Traber very ostentatiously sets up his own fund in support of victims of the war, very ostentatiously talks about how much he's donating to Leningradsky Rubezh, which is an aid fund created by Leningrad region governor at the time, Drozdenko. Indeed, Traber actually chairs its board of trustees. But in reality, there is a strong suspicion that actually only a fraction of the monies that are meant to go into the fund actually do. The rest is in effect laundered through the fund. A lot of it is being sent abroad, it seems. All of this being said, all of this relationship with all kinds of dodgy deals, international transactions of questionable merit, a whole morgue's worth of corpses strewing his economic career, there's never been a single legal case against Traber in Russia. Now, is he actually the most honest man in St. Petersburg? Or the cleverest? Or the best connected? Now, writing about this case, Moskovsky Komsomolets wrote, "The era of authoritative business," in other words, business carried out by authoriteti, authorities, which is the general term for the sort of the new generation commercially minded criminal kingpins compared to the Vori Vazakonye of the old order. Anyway, the new era of authoritative business in St. Petersburg has ended. Has it really? I mean, in a way, what we are seeing is obviously an onslaught against the old world of Banditsky Petersburg, which, of course, now has become Banditsky Pensioner Petersburg, really, because that's the sort of generation of criminals who are being taken down. Why? Why now? And why was Traber's arrest personally supervised by the first deputy head of the FSB, Sergei Karalyov? I've set the scene up. Now, after the break, let's consider the wider implications of this tale and why quite I am so excited by it. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counterterrorism, and civil affairs. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian, get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, including articles I've written, the most weekly Govorit Moskva press briefing, and other bonus content like the Chronicles of a Different Russia Alternative Histories. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galeotti or on Facebook, Mark Galeotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. Before I move on to the fun stuff, just a quick note for patrons, paying patrons, there will be no Govorit Moskva this week because I'm travelling. There will be something else arriving in your inboxes on Wednesday morning, though. And secondly, the first episode will soon drop of what should be a monthly video series called Bratva, Brotherhood, which I'll be hosting for the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organised Crime. The first episode is actually about how another case illustrates what's going on within the wider Russian underworld and the death of the old Vorovskoy Mir, the old thieves' world. Anyway, I will be sort of announcing that when it actually comes out, but it will be dropping soon. And I think it's quite fun. So, why now? Well, the first point is it could well be about ports. Traber's case is at least in part down to investigations that have been carried out by Directorate T of the FSB's Counterintelligence Service. Its remit is the security of transport infrastructure, so Russian railways, Aeroflot, and yes, indeed, ports. And from 2022 until this year, its deputy head had been Major General Sergei Demyanishnikov. Now, apparently, he had made a particular pet project, shall we say, of the embezzlement from the Primorsk project, from which Traber, and in some ways doing what is the norm of the times, certainly not in war, but anyway, Traber had been reportedly siphoning off huge sums from this project. And remember, this is a project that was the one that backed by a loan from Vnesheconom Bank when Putin intervened. The sum of 2 billion rubles disappearing, so that's more than 20 million pounds, for example, has been mentioned. This clearly is especially problematic when you're in a time when, courtesy of Ukrainian drones, not least hitting Traber's own port at Ust-Luga, but nonetheless, Russia needs its export ports. And this whole scandal had indeed come to the attention of Andrei Nikitin, the Minister of Transport. What happened in March? Well, Demyanishnikov moved to a new post, head of the FSB Directorate for St. Petersburg and the Leningrad region. And then, in June, Putin coincidentally held separate face-to-face meetings with Nikitin to discuss the situation with the ports of the Leningrad region, including Primorsk, and Igor Rudenya, the newly appointed plenipotentiary presidential envoy to the Northwestern Federal District, who seems to have had his own beefs with Traber. So this could well be about ports. It could well be about an ambitious FSB officer with an axe to grind and a career to make that knows that a very high-profile scalp like Traber's could be the making, or if you get it wrong, the breaking, of a career. But would that have been enough to get Traber arrested, and particularly arrested in such a visible way? It would need Putin's okay. And even if the Primorsk port does seem to be a strategic necessity, Traber could simply have been quietly reprimanded. He could have been required to return the money. He could have had his access to the port removed by nationalisation or whatever else. There are other ways of doing it. So although I think this is an interesting case, and I'm sure Demyanishnikov's investigation and the fact that this was happening from an oil export port is significant, I don't think it's the whole story. So we need to get even deeper into the rabbit hole. And here, look, I imagine that people have a suspicion that, like in the films and TV programs, I have some great big huge board in my room with photos and printouts all connected by different coloured strings. And, let me be honest, if every wall were not covered in bookcases, by God, yes, I would have such a board. But yes, we have to get into somewhat conspiratorial territory. The other, and certainly the one that generally is being sort of alluded to publicly, pretext for this arrest is the case of Petrov. Now, Local deputy and businessman Alexander Petrov was pretty much boss of Vyborg, a town to the northwest of St. Petersburg, which included the Vyborg shipyard and the Vyborg fuel company. Very much within, I would suggest, the orbit, shall we say, of St. Petersburg. Now, the media dubbed Petrov the master of Vyborg because of his influence in the city. And in fact, in 2016, Petrov asked journalists to stop calling him that. And so as a result, journalists began calling him hashtag not the master of Vyborg, which I did rather like. But anyway, Petrov was in October 2020, leaving the bathhouse on his country estate when he was gunned down by a sniper. Two bullets at long range, apparently a highly professional job. Now, given all the circumstances surrounding his death, investigative committee head Alexander Bastrykin decided to take personal control of the criminal case. Now, on one level, this is not at all surprising because Bastrykin likes to position himself at the front of any kind of highly media-friendly story. But, well, it's worth noting that Petrov may also have played a role in getting Bastrykin his job. I'll come on to it a little bit more in a moment. So there could have been a little bit more to it than that. Anyway, the word seems to be that it was Traber who ordered this contract killing. Petrov had once been Traber's right-hand man. I mean, they met back in the 1990s when they were sort of operating together at the Druzhba Hotel, where they both later owned shares in the local casino. It's worth noting, one of the businesses that Putin oversaw was, of course, the gambling industry, the legal gambling industry within St. Petersburg. You know, the connections continue to be made. And these days, one of his key roles, other than just simply making money on his own account, was in managing smuggling through Vyborg port for Traber. The thing is, Petrov had apparently started selling off his assets. He was planning to leave the country to live with his son, Vitaly, who is the first Russian Formula One driver. Apparently, I don't know much about Formula One, apparently nicknamed the Vyborg Rocket. As so often happens when cashing out, that's obviously often one of the dangerous points in these kind of criminal ventures, because clearly a lot of the assets in question are not exactly on the book and ownership can be contested. Anyway, he and Traber fell out over the apportionment of the proceeds. Now, this is an entirely possible reason for why Traber, who is not a man to even now, now that he's 74 years old, even now not to be crossed, could have gone after Petrov. Again, though, I'm not sure if it is enough to have led to this arrest. It could well be the pretext for going after Traber. You know, the Sledcom is shocked to discover that murder has taken place in this establishment. But no, given that Putin would have had to green light, I think we need to look something else, something different, something personal, something political. So, this is the third possible explanation, about kompromat, about compromising material. The Vyechika Ogpu social media site, which specialises in rather lurid claims about sort of criminal wrongdoings among the Russian elite, and it has to be said has, let's call it a very variable level of accuracy. Anyway, they have said that these days Traber has effectively been living in Europe and even married a Latvian 52 years younger than him. He came to St. Petersburg, though, for meetings in the margins of the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, which provided the FSB an opportunity to grab him because he knows too much about Putin's murky past. And it says that allowing such a person to remain in Europe is too dangerous. Well, maybe. However, I'm not convinced that Traber necessarily was living in Europe most of the time. It's worth noting, after all, he was on Interpol's wanted list until the end of last year. If anyone out there knows better, please do tell me. There's also very little reason to believe that Traber would, after a lifetime of discretion, be willing to spill any such spicy beans, not least as he must have known what would happen, not just to his assets inside Russia, but to him. Once again, this is not the first time I've felt this about Vyechika Ogpu. You know, it's offered as a fun, but ultimately, I think, implausible story. So, next story that's doing the rounds that, again, might have some seeds of truth in it, but ultimately I think is problematic, is of a rivalry with some senior FSB people. So there's the claim that Traber was involved in a bitter dispute with Anatoly Yablonsky, who is a shadowy businessman with all kinds of interests, from booze to telecoms. But he, in turn, this argument goes, is a client of FSB Deputy Director Yevgeny Lovyarev. Now, this is very widely claimed. You see it being picked up all over the place. It's a tiny problem. Lovyarev is not a deputy director of the FSB, or rather he isn't anymore, having retired from the FSB in 2004. Now, that was 22 years ago. So I don't exactly see him as any great mover and shaker, because I mean, for years his main role has been as president of the Dynamo Moscow Women's Volleyball Club. And I don't think there's too much that you can do from that particular basis. But there is actually a much more interesting potential FSB angle, and this is when we get to Karalyov. The smart money, I think, is that Yablonsky's original FSB patron back in the days was not Lovyarev, but Colonel General Viktor Voronin, who until 2016 was the head of the FSB's Economic Security Service, that's the SEB, its Department K, and who was incidentally, this is indeed just tangential, but you know, one of the prime movers in the original case against Bill Browder that led to the arrest and death of his tax accountant, Sergei Magnitsky. Anyway, Voronin, he's old news these days. His place as Yablonsky's krisha, its roof, his protector, was taken first by Ivan Tkachev, who was once head of the 6th Directorate of the Internal Security Service. Yeah, you know, I know, this is where exactly you need to have a board with notations and all sorts of strings. But anyway, Tkachev was head of a particular department of the Internal Security Service of the FSB. So in other words, the sort of spook watchers. And this was the unit that became known as Sechin Spetsnaz, because Igor Sechin, the old long-term bagman of Putin's, who is now head of Rosneft, essentially had compromised and corrupted it and was using it as his own personal hit squad. Now, Tkachev would then go on to take